Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we conduct weird and wonderful science directly into your brain. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, Calvin Iber talks about what your eyes are doing. But first up, here's a blood test for chronic fatigue syndrome. Diagnosing chronic fatigue syndrome? For the last few years, researchers around the world have been finding all sorts of biological markers for myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, ME-CFS. They hope these biological markers will lead to cheap, fast and easy to use diagnostic tests. While there isn't a cure for chronic fatigue syndrome, a diagnostic test would help people suffering the disease to get advice on how to live with the condition without making it worse. Myalgic encephalomyelitis is an illness characterized by severe physical and mental exhaustion after work or exercise that's way out of proportion to the effort and energy that people have spent. People also suffer from immune problems, inflammation, digestive issues, pain, and neurological symptoms such as memory and concentration problems. Researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine have conducted a pilot study based on how people's immune cells respond to stress using a nanoelectronic assay. Nanoelectronic assays measure small changes in electrical activity of cells. They tested 20 people with symptoms of CFS and 20 healthy controls. The diagnostic technology contains thousands of electrodes that create an electrical current, as well as chambers to hold blood samples composed of immune cells and plasma. Inside the chambers, immune cells and plasma interfere with the electrical current, changing its flow from one end to the other. The change in electrical activity is directly correlated with the health of the blood sample. In this test, they stress the samples from both healthy and ill patients using salt. They compare how each sample affects the flow of the electrical current when it's stressed. The bigger the change in current, the bigger the reaction the immune cells are having to being stressed. All 20 of the blood samples from the ME-CFS patients created a clear spike in the test, whereas those taken from healthy controls were flat. The researchers stress that although the test was able to identify all of the people with chronic fatigue syndrome, they don't know why those immune cells are reacting so strongly to stress. They're recruiting people at Stanford to take part in a much larger trial to confirm their results. Now that they can quickly and cheaply detect immune cells in blood reacting to stress, they can screen drugs to treat chronic fatigue syndrome by seeing if they affect this stress reaction. Drugs that calm down this electrical spike in immune reaction may turn out to be effective treatments for chronic fatigue syndrome. The researchers have identified their first drug candidate this way, but they don't yet have the resources to put on a full clinical trial of the drug's effectiveness in treating chronic fatigue syndrome. Sadly, it's currently on the shelf. However, all of the drugs they're testing are either already approved by the Food and Drug Administration or will soon be accessible to the public, which is key to getting treatments out to the public as soon as possible. The test's effectiveness will have to be confirmed in this full-size trial before it'll become available for doctors to use in diagnosis. Their paper was titled A Nanoelectronics Blood-Based Diagnostic Biomarker for Myalgic Encephalomyelitis Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, ME-CFS, and was presented at the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Because so many Americans think getting drunk is fun, we thought you might like to join us in a national drinking game. Just answer yes or no to the following 10 questions. Do you talk a lot about drinking?
Only when I'm awake.
Do you drink more than you used to?
I try to.
Do you gulp your drinks?
Only out of a glass.
Do you often take a drink to feel better? Do you drink alone?
Only if I'm stuck.
Do you ever forget what you did while you were drinking? Do you keep a bottle hidden somewhere for quick pick-me-ups?
How does he know?
Do you sometimes start drinking without really thinking about it?
Sometimes.
Do you need a drink to have fun?
I do now.
Do you ever take a drink in the morning to relieve a hangover?
Uh-huh.
Congratulations. If you had four or more yes answers, then you may be one of over 9 million Americans with a drinking problem.
Psychiatrist David Nutt has been working for the last 10 years on a replacement for alcohol that will make you feel as good, relaxed and buzzed, but doesn't give you any of the hangovers, loss of control, blackouts, cancer, liver disease or crippling addiction. His alcohol replacement is called Alcorel, and it may be on sale in as little as 5 years. It's one thing to produce a safe new recreational drug, it's a whole other thing to have it accepted by the government. I believe society would accept it alongside alcohol, as long as Alcorel is not seen as taking alcohol away. David Nutt first invented an alcohol antidote in 1983, a drug that sobered up drunks. Nutt gave rats alcohol that administered a chemical that blocks GABA receptors in the brain, and the rats sobered up. He'd proved that alcohol stimulates the GABA system in the brain, which calms you and makes you feel tipsy. Unfortunately, if you gave the drug to a sober person, they would suffer the sort of seizures that people get when they withdraw from alcohol cold turkey. And of course, while the drunk person became sober, the alcohol was still eroding their liver and brain. If only he could stimulate the GABA system in a way that didn't harm people's health, so that you could get tipsy without hurting yourself. This is what Alcorel does. Nutt has designed a molecule that binds to the GABA receptors in such a way that there's a limit to how drunk you can get, no matter how much Alcorel you drink. David Nutt's 5-year plan includes proving Alcorel is safe, proving Alcorel doesn't have alcohol's harmful effects, getting it approved as a food additive, and partnering with the drinks industry to create and sell the new Alcorel drinks. They're also searching for natural sources of Alcorel, so it doesn't have to be synthesized, and for the marketing angle of a natural product. Here's Star Trek The Next Generation.
Can I help you, sir?
Aye, lad. Scotch. Neat.
There you go, sir.
Thank you. What in blazes is this?
Didn't you order scotch?
Laddie, I was drinking scotch 100 years before you were born, and I can tell you that whatever this is, it is definitely not scotch.
I believe I may be of some assistance. Captain Scott is unaware of the existence of synthahol.
Synthahol?
Yes, sir. It is an alcohol substitute now being served aboard starships. It simulates the appearance, taste, and smell of alcohol, but the intoxicating effects can be easily dismissed.
You're not quite, human, are you?
No, sir. I am an android. Lieutenant Commander Data.
Synthetic scotch, synthetic commanders.
You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Calvin Iber is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Sydney. Calvin is part of a team working in the ARC Centre of Excellence in Integrative Brain Function and the Save Sight Institute at the University of Sydney. I began by asking him what happens to signals sent from your eyes to your brain.
So the optic nerve comes out of the back of your eye
and it goes back up into your brain. And that's where all sorts of interesting effects are applied to this signal. And I'm not going to call it a raw signal. It's not a raw signal coming out of your optic nerve, but it's a little bit like a compressed version of the image that is falling through your lens, through the optics of your eye, onto the retina, which is the layer of nerve cells, or layers, rather, of nerve cells at the back of the eye. And we're looking at this slightly compressed visual signal that's being transmitted by nerves, and we're looking at primarily the first part of the brain where that signal terminates deep in the brain in an area of the brain called the thalamus. And then that signal, after it has been locally processed in the thalamus, is then relayed up into the visual cortex, which is where most of the human experience or human experience of vision is thought to begin.
So signals from the eye don't all go straight to the visual cortex. There's a whole lot of other things that happen before they get passed on to the visual cortex of the brain.
And we're discovering more and more things that are happening as we go on. Back when these areas of the brain were first discovered, maybe 100 years ago, maybe even more, we thought that these were simple relay nuclei, that they just took the signal in, passed the signal up. But when we actually went in and started counting cells and looking at all of the different synaptic connections that are made in this part of the brain, we realized that feedback from the brain into this area outnumbers the signals that are being sent up the optic nerve in terms of synapses by a factor of at least 10 to 1.
And what does this center do? Do we know?
So, I mean, we can describe a lot of it in terms of basic visual signal processing. And in fact, a lot of our ideas for how things like deep neural networks do signal processing nowadays came from studying areas like this. But the basic, the sort of the big theories and the very sort of simplistic overarching theories describe it as taking some of the temporal redundancy out of the data so that it can fit down a smaller pipeline of neurons, and any change that remains after you've taken out all of this redundancy is more important for the brain to act on.
So it's working out what's more important for the brain to act on.
Yes, and if you really think about it, working out what's more important is a little bit like saying the question, what should I be paying attention to? And some of the other research that has been done shows that when you decide that you're going to try to pay attention to something, like I'm going to pay attention to that thing over there, or I'm going to pay attention to the blue stuff in the room because I'm looking for somebody who's wearing a blue shirt, then in order for that sort of stated higher level goal that you've come up with for yourself to actually have an effect on what you're able to see and make your visual processing more efficient, it has to change your visual processing. And there's a lot of evidence now that these sorts of changes happen at these very, very, very low levels of the brain, right at the first synapse in the brain for the visual signal. And this could also work for auditory signals, also work for sensory signals. And there's some evidence that this process going wrong is why people develop sensory sensitivities when they have conditions like autism.
So their filtering's not working properly and they're getting overwhelmed with noise.
That's a hypothesis, but yes.
But of course that can happen in other conditions as well.
Yes, and depending on just the way that it works out, you could conceivably experience hallucinations if you were getting input into these cells that was masquerading as retinal input. But of course, it's very hard, like these are hypotheses, and it's very hard to work out how to treat any of these things if we don't really have a clear idea of how it's supposed to work in the first place.
And is this sort of pre-processing why we can react quicker than conscious thought to things moving straight at us?
That's a very good hypothesis as well. There's definitely circuits in this area of the brain, and there's circuits in other areas of the brain that we study as well, an area called the superior colliculus, which are involved in what you described. We would call that a looming stimulus. And these sorts of circuits for getting out of the way of things they're very old. They're much more ancient than our circuits for doing things like fine vision, like when you're trying to look at really small text. That's a relatively new addition to our visual arsenal. These sorts of get out of the way of the predator circuits are older, more well-established, but they actually only make up a tiny percentage of the visual pathway. 80% of the cells here are processing fine, high detail, because you need it for high detail. And then only around 20% of the cells are processing signals for avoidance, signals for motion. And even of that 20% of the cells, we only really have a really clear understanding of about half of those work.
And how do you go about studying these signals?
So we can use anatomical work, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute, but we can use anatomical work to come up with hypotheses about how the living brain works. And anatomical work is where you take a brain, and either it's a brain that's been donated to science by somebody when they die, or it's a brain that we have taken out of an animal after we've obtained permission and made sure that the animal's put down very, very gently. But in either of these cases, you take the brain and you process it with chemicals to look for the synaptic markers, the chemicals that show how different neurons are connected together. And you also actually have to label the neurons themselves because they're quite small. You can't see them just under a light microscope the way you can with lots of other tissues like liver tissue or heart tissue or lung tissue. So you stain the cells, you stain the synapses, and you can form hypotheses and measure connections. And this is really important work, and it can inform computational modeling so that we don't have to go back into animals and continue doing research. But in order to actually answer the questions, after we've come up with good hypotheses from the modeling, after we've known what we expect, we do have to go back into animals, and you anesthetize the animal, so there's no pain involved, no stress involved. And while the animal's anesthetized, you have to go in and you have to go into their brain and actually measure the signal. There's no way around it.
So can you look at the living situation as well, like the live feed from the eyes?
That's exactly right. And that's what we do. And that's what our laboratory has specialized in, is looking at these living feeds from the eye to the brain, looking at all the different feedback processes that are happening from the brain back into these areas, and trying to map out how brain waves up at the level of the visual cortex influence and control activity at the cellular levels as it's passing signals from the eye to the brain.
So you're examining signals as they come from living eyes into the brain. How's it done?
So we anesthetize our animals so that they're fast asleep. There's no pain. They're not getting stressed out. We monitor their like levels of stress and blood pressure and things like that. So you knock your animal out, and then you actually do have to open up and go in and put an electrode into the brain to measure these sorts of signals. Then, and basically once you've got that, you basically just have a scene on a computer monitor that you play at the animal. And the cells, even though we know that the animals are fast asleep, the cells which do this low-level visual processing still process all of these signals. And so that's how we do it.
You're going at the basics of how vision works.
Very much so. And this is useful. I mean, we've talked a little bit about conditions where visual perception is disrupted, like autism and schizophrenia. But honestly, this is all very useful if you want to do something like build a self-driving car, because the sorts of visual processing that we describe when we talk about visual processing hierarchies in the brain, that's what's getting built into self-driving cars. And that's going to do a lot more good in terms of people not getting run over and people not crashing into one another after a night out.
Is this work, do you think, likely to help people that have lost their vision or have reduced vision?
Certainly, there are things that we are looking at to try to open up possibilities. And it's all very preliminary, so I couldn't really I don't want to say, yes, come to us, we'll cure your blindness. That's not what we're doing. We are, however, trying to find molecules that are disrupted so that when we start looking for cures, we know which pathways to look for molecules for cures in so that we can discover new drugs. But we're not the ones doing the chemistry to discover the new drugs. We're doing the sort of the basic mapping of what's down there so that when somebody comes along and develops a new drug and says, oh, this changes the action of this such and such receptor in the brain, then us or anyone who's read both of those papers can say, oh, if that changes such and such action in the brain, then that means that we should be able to repair this thing that gets broken when vision is lost because it's part of this visual pathway.
I guess you can also warn people what not to change because you've mapped out how things work and they might get drugs that interact badly with the chemicals that are doing the sensing.
That's absolutely true. Something like 90% of all drugs don't make it through to commercialization. And even at like the stage of stage 3 trials where you've done all of your preclinical work, you've done all of your preliminary clinical work, when you look at side effects, I think more than half of those at that very expensive stage of testing get kicked out. And part of that is because when we're looking for molecules, we sort of assume that rodents and humans have very similar physiology. And that's true at a molecular level in terms of the basic building blocks of life are the same. But when you're looking at more and more assembled levels, when you're caring about things like cell types and what kind of cell carries what kind of signal, then it's actually no longer true that animals that we typically use in the laboratory, like rats and mice, work in order to tell us how human health is going to be changed, especially in the brain, how human health is going to be changed by different drugs. I don't want to say that animal testing is bad or that rodent work doesn't work. I mean, definitely there's a lot of good work that needs to be done in these areas, but we do need to know how that rodent work and how that kind of lab rat, lab mouse genetic testing translates into animals who are like ourselves.
And so you have to look at animals that are closer to us.
Yes, you do. You try not to use too many of them, though.
And how did you come to study this particular part of the brain when you were looking at the signals from the eye?
I sort of stumbled into it, really. My PhD work, I did my dissertation working on the recording in the retina as opposed to recording in the brain and looking at visual signals. So when there was an opportunity for me to move up into the brain and start learning more about how these signals that are being sent from the retina are then processed higher up, it felt like an important ladder to climb. That's me personally, though. There's a lot of exciting science that's being done at the really, really basic discovery stage that shows us new ways to understand what it is that makes us human. And I'm talking about ways to understand where our experience comes from. And knowing just what circuit in the brain is going quick when I'm looking at the color blue or the color yellow or when something gets my attention, that doesn't make those colors any less vibrant. And I think there's this big belief that the more you know about something, the less amazing it is. And that's just not true.
Well, Calvin Iber, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
That was Calvin Iber doing basic research into how vision works, how signals from your eyes are treated by your brain, in a team from the ARC Center of Excellence in Integrative Brain Function at the Save Sight Institute at the University of Sydney. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you an artist, scientist, biohacker or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Do you have a science outreach grant that I should apply for? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Become my patron at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.